You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education Issue Review podcast for the edition covering the 5th to the 11th of May 2016. My name's John Gill. I'm the editor of Times Higher Education and I'm joined today by reporters Matthew Rice, Ellie Bothwell and John Elms. A stellar lineup, if I may say. And in the magazine this week, we have, amongst other things, reports from our second annual Africa University Summit, which we held at the University of Ghana last week. Ellie was there in Accra, I understand it's pronounced, not Accra, for our reporting team. She'll be taking us through some of the highlights of the conference in just a moment. Another of our highlights this year, where does the duty of care lie for PhD students abroad? This is obviously a very hot topic. The recent murder of Cambridge doctoral student Giulio Regeni has posed some very difficult questions for universities about the extent to which they're responsible for PhD students when they do travel for their research. And John Elms has been asking some of the key figures in the sector where that responsibility lies and where the line is as far as having to have that responsibility. And third, we have a record number of universities in LGBT rights charity Stonewall's latest list of the UK's 100 most inclusive employers. We've asked six academics for their perspectives on being LGBT within the academy, and we'll hear from Matthew Rice on that. But first, Ellie, you were in Ghana last week at the Africa University Summit. A fascinating event, first time around in Joburg. I wasn't able to join the team in Accra this year, but just talk us through some of the topics that were discussed and what the tone of the event was.
Yeah, it was actually a very sort of positive sort of atmosphere at the event. People were sort of seemed sort of very proud about how kind of far Africa has come in the last few years and how far higher education systems have come, as well as sort of recognising some of the challenges. So I spoke to the Vice Chancellor at the University of Ghana, who spoke about sort of Africa's increased sort of publication output in recent years, and he was saying that actually it's not necessarily that scholars are producing more research, but it's that the academics that are collaborating with institutions in the West having much more equal partnerships. They're not just seen as data gatherers, but they're actually, you know, their names are actually on the research and they're being credited properly. I mean, unequal partnerships kind of was still a part of the debate at the conference. It's clear that sort of not all universities in the West are sort of doing this as much as they should be. But it definitely seems like it's improved.
Was there just picking up on that topic, was there a sort of blueprint that came out of the discussion about how to get really kind of meaningful equal partnerships? Is it, for example, a question of picking areas of research where Africa has specific and unique strengths? Some of the issues around, I don't know, agriculture, for example, which is a really big deal in that part of the world. Perhaps automatically there's strength there which African universities can play up, which they may not be in, you know, picking a subject out of thin air, physics or
yeah,
like that.
I think it was definitely about sort of identifying certain subject areas, and also on that kind of on that note, also just ensuring that the partnerships are really led by Africa. There are lots of universities in the West that maybe, you know, that they want Africa's input, but maybe they're kind of wanting too much control over what that research topic is going to be as well. And actually, it's that, you know, in order for Africa to develop, it has to sort of be in control of its own research agenda. The Vice President of Ghana was also at the event, and he sort of spoke about the need for institutions to kind of diversify funding. He sent out quite a strong message when he said that universities sort of must break away from their reliance on the poor taxpayer for funding, and that if they do, that will kind of help preserve their independence and academic freedom. So I think I don't know if all of the delegates kind of wholly agreed with that argument, but that was certainly the direction he said he was going to go.
And where was he looking when he talked about alternative sources of funding? What was he thinking of there? Was he thinking of tuition fees as an additional resource, or you know, capital markets in terms of some of the sort of private elements that we've seen creeping into African higher education in a fairly significant way? What was his?
Yeah, I think he was sort of any of those streams, really. I think he was just kind of sending out a message that basically, you know, the government isn't going to kind of necessarily keep helping them, and that I think fees and private sources. A few people spoke about kind of how some public universities across Africa, even though they're public universities and generally their students don't pay fees, they have some kind of private students which do pay fees, and then that seems to be quite a good kind of revenue stream for some of them.
Yeah, I think one of the things that occurred to me after our last Africa Summit is there's a slightly antagonistic relationship, it seemed to me, between universities and government. I mean, it's very easy to generalise. Africa is not a country, it's a continent, and, you know, there's all sorts of different models. But I think one of the things that came out then was Thabo Mbeki, who spoke at our Joburg summit, talked about the sort of traditional model of government in Africa, which is a very strong centralised power base, and some politicians seeing universities as a sort of alternative power base that actually, in some ways, was a sort of rival to governments, and they felt that actually, you know, they saw central government funding as a way to control the university. So it could well be that there's a similar point being made here, that if universities can diversify and move away from central funding, they will win back some of that autonomy and freedom that we know is so important to the sort of development of, you know, what we would term world-class higher education systems, which I know is what Africa wants ultimately. So it sounds like some very strong continuity between the two events. Well, thanks for that, Eddie. The coverage of our summit goes across two pages in the magazine this week, on pages 8 and 9, and of course you can also find all that and more online. Now, John, we've moved to you. You've been looking at another issue of very great significance internationally, the duty of care for PhD students when they're undertaking doctoral research in potentially dangerous situations. I mean, I know that you know, all researchers who travel to you know, difficult environments face challenges and risks, and that's part of the job, I suppose. But there probably is a special duty of care to younger, newer researchers that are just sort of starting to get in, you know, don't necessarily know quite what they're getting themselves into always. Is this a big issue? Is this something that's very commonplace?
Yeah, very much so. As you mentioned earlier, obviously this is stemmed from the tragic circumstances of Giulio Regeni, who was murdered while undertaking his own doctoral research in Cairo back in February. And it got us thinking, does the sector, you know, have a sector line on what the duty of care is for PhD, also where it lies for PhD students? So I decided to contact some of the people in the sector. I went to the principal source of where most of the research funding comes from, Research Councils UK, whose member organisations do so. And, because they provide grants and funding towards institutions, they're not particularly students. They said that there's a responsibility on the research organisations, in other words, universities, for ensuring safe working environment for their PhD students, both in the university, of course, and outside. And, you know, that extends further in the health and safety aspect of the conditions of research training grants, where they said that the institutions are responsible for ensuring that a safe working environment is provided. Appropriate care must be taken where researchers are working off-site, and they expect organisations to undertake safety risk assessment in individual cases. So I suppose that, you know, that kind of shows that the institutions have responsibility. And I think when you get to more granular level, that, you know, universities across the board have their own stringent risk assessments.
Yeah, I mean, how meaningful is risk assessment? Is it just box ticking so that universities can say after the fact, well, we assessed this, we were aware of the risks, everybody went into it with their eyes open? It's a bit like journalism, isn't it?
Well,
if you
quite,
said
a
war reporter off to Syria to cover the war, there's clearly huge risk involved in that, but actually that's part and parcel of the job.
Of course. There's no indication that universities, the people I spoke to, see it as a box ticking exercise. I mean, for certain situations, you know, I spoke to Glenn Rangwala from the Department of Politics and Internationals at Cambridge, who knew Giulio Regeni and helps sort out PhD students in that department. And he said, you know, for some people going off to, say, Westminster to interview a politician, it's a quite laborious exercise for all involved, yet they still do it. However, when it comes to putting, you know, a PhD student.
They do a risk assessment if you go and interview George Osborne.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they still do it. They have to be careful. I mean, there are different levels, of course, but
what's,
you know,
the risk?
Well, I don't know. You might get your head bitten off by a politician.
You might vote Tory.
But yeah, you know, he did say that any students conducting research offsite, outside of Cambridge, outside the confines of the university, will have to put a risk assessment, and the case of Julia, which was important, was that it was no different from any doctoral student. You know, there's this concern that because he was in a particularly dangerous environment, there might have been some, you know, something might have gone missing. But no, it was completely stringent policies and risk assessment, and it was carried out extremely thoroughly.
And I think Matthew, maybe bring you in here. We have a regular series called The Outer Limits, where we talk to academics who often have gone into slightly extreme environments, in some cases extreme only in the sense that they're, you know, researching in a cloud forest, or, you know, which perhaps isn't dangerous necessarily, and others
often health
much more dangerous, yes, in the sense that you're spending time with a Mujahideen or someone like that, and yeah. Clearly in those cases they're often more senior academics, I suppose, so they're probably more experienced. But you'll have spoken, I know you've done a lot of that series for us, you'll have spoken to some people who have ended up in some very, potentially very hairy situations. Do you get the feeling that this sort of, dare I say it, slightly bureaucratic approach to risk is in any danger of hindering research, or do you think academics would find that, you know, a helpful and useful administrative check and balance, if you like?
Well, I think we have had, I'm sure we've published opinions in the past where academics have taken the line, it's a bit like the sort of grumbles about health and safety, you know, it was great in the good old days. We all knew, we all knew it was pretty dangerous to go to some of these places, but that was part of the excitement, and you were learning about things you couldn't learn about it otherwise, and often if you go to a war zone, it's very important. And somehow, it's become too safe now, and people do make that argument, although it tends to be a particular temperament. I mean, clearly people do find living in hardship and difficult situations in some way stimulating and exciting, as well as frightening and upsetting. And, you know, often feel, if, you know, I don't know, working with very poor people, if you feel that your research might actually help them in some way, can feel genuinely important in a way that some academic research doesn't. So I think there is a trade-off.
Yeah,
I mean, that what Matthew says is an interesting point. Of course, one of the other people I spoke to, Derek Willens, who's vice principal for research and provost at University of St Andrews, so he deals with all of this. He actually told me it's not included in the piece that, you know, there's a degree of difference with an academic, so a fully fledged. Professor who's done, say, 20 years research, he said, although his concern is still great for the person, he's less concerned that they won't, you know, they know what they're doing. He's more concerned when it's a PhD student, when they, as you say, are learning the ropes, as it were, and are discussing with a supervisor about appropriate places to go and things to do on research.
Yeah.
Of course, so, you know, the number one concern is safety. But that said, he also accounts for the point that, you know, at the end of the day, this is academic research, and academic freedom is very important. That's why a lot of people said the attack on Giulio Vergiani wasn't just a personal attack, it was an attack on academic freedom, because he's stopping these academics from doing so. So I think the ultimate, aside from the risk assessments that everyone undertakes, every university has guidance on and stringent rules on, as long as the researcher, the PhD student, or early career academic has understood all the dangers involved, filled out the recognisable forms, got approval to travel, you know, if they're really then set on doing their research, it's not really in the position for anyone to tell them what research they can do.
No, absolutely. Which is a very important point. Well, it's a really interesting issue, and I think obviously the circumstances surrounding Giulio Regeni's death are still being investigated, and it's a topic we'll watch very closely as that unfolds. Finally, Matthew, you've written or been involved in commissioning our cover feature this week, which is looking at what it's like to be gay in the academy. You've spoken to half a dozen people with different perspectives on this issue. What was your sort of overall impression? Is the Academy, as you would expect, a welcoming place to be gay, or are there issues still to be dealt with that, that lurk below the liberal surface, if you like?
Well, I think the answer is both. I mean, most of the people who've been in the Academy for quite a while or had experience of other countries or other sectors, you know, were saying that it was, you know, it was pretty good. I mean, there was a lot of terrible upset around the time of the AIDS epidemic. And Gregory Woods, who one of the people we talked about, who spoke to, was the first professor of gay and lesbian studies in Britain and got a lot of certainly mockery and to some extent abuse even from politicians. So I think there is a very big sense in which things have got a lot better. Obviously, Britain is less homophobic than many countries, and that this sector is doing pretty well. On the other hand, there were, and I suppose the one exception to this is there's a transgender woman is one of the people who wrote for us, and her experience is rather tragic. Painful anyway. She had not a bad experience with the university, but she had colleagues who just didn't know how to deal with her, and that was obviously very painful. So that's a rather different experience from the experiences of gay and lesbians, who on the whole have a fairly positive story to tell. But there are always things that they feel are important. One of the people who wrote is an engineer, a lesbian engineer, and she thinks that in some subjects, and it probably also in engineering as a profession, it's much harder to be openly gay. And in her university, they were discussing this, and there were very few openly gay people in her department, and they couldn't work out whether it was because people didn't work, that people didn't apply or were, you know, or got jobs but didn't feel it was safe to be out. And there are still underlying issues of how much the curriculum needs to be revised to take account of it's not difficult to find textbooks which are mildly homophobic and certainly don't give an LGBT perspective very much credence or attention. So there are, there are always issues, and one of our contributors was particularly concerned to draw out the areas where she feels there is still much to be done. But I think, on the other hand, everybody said, it could be a lot worse. It has been a lot worse, and is a lot worse in other countries. I guess it's not surprising, but it's still.
I think it's interesting that on the sort of trans issue that you mentioned, that's very much an issue that's being driven in this country, the discussion about transphobia and so on, by the NUS, isn't it?
Yes.
So they're pushing very strongly along that road. So clearly an issue that's a hot topic among students as well. One of the things that struck me reading this was that we didn't have any of the horror stories that I remember reading a piece in, I think it was The Atlantic, but one of the big US magazines, about a gay student, a student rather than academic, we've primarily spoken to academics, but a gay student at one of the big Christian universities in the US, the sort of Bible Belt institutions, and the sort of awful time that they had. And I suppose that's an added dimension to the US sector that we don't have here so much in the UK, where you have this very evangelical mission behind some of the higher education institutions. But I guess you didn't find any institutions that had a kind of institutional bias against any of the people you spoke to?
No, though I suppose it would be hard to find. There might be a self-selected process on both sides when you're talking about academics. I mean, certainly nobody said that they'd been, people had told them they would go to hell or anything like that. Several people quote rather nasty comments or comments which they think are actually homophobic, were pretending not to be homophobic. But no, I think the whole religious dimension is rather different.
Okay, well, it's a fascinating piece, and if we, among the interviews we do have a piece from Dominic Shellard, who is one of the only openly gay vice chancellors in this country, if not the only openly gay vice chancellor currently. So that's it for this week's issue review. As always, complete coverage of the latest HE news, features and books can be found in the magazine and on the website. If you'd like to make a comment on any of these issues discussed, or indeed on any of the content in this week's issue, please do get in touch with us. Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, all the usual places. We'd love to hear from you. But that's it from us. Until next week's issue review, goodbye.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.